Company from 1986, which holds that a party seeking class certification has the burden to prove that all the class certification elements are met. And it's also inconsistent with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23, which this court in the Trapp case said it would look to in matters of class certification, that the party seeking certification must show actual, not presumed, conformance with the class certification rule, and that the court must conduct a rigorous analysis to determine if the requirements for class certification are met. Those requirements were laid down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1982 in the case of General Telephone Company versus Falcon. The plaintiffs below urged...
I know that the trial judge in this did issue a 36-page memorandum. That could be quite rigorous under our standards here. Do you say that he didn't do his job, or are you just saying that he erred in how he applied the law?
He erred in how he applied the law. I know the respect with which Justice Sanders is held in this court and in the state of South Dakota, and he certainly did his job as best he could. But he was led astray by the plaintiffs, who convinced him to adopt an erroneous legal standard. And the legal standard falls short in four areas, Your Honor. And Justice Amundson, I'd be glad to articulate what those are.
Yeah, it'd be interesting hearing that.
First, the circuit court below held that the plaintiff's method for proving damages with common proof need only be, quote, not so insubstantial and illusory as to amount to no method at all. That is an error of law. That's in paragraph 15 of the circuit court's opinion. The circuit court should have required the plaintiff's expert, who came forward with theories that were just based on theory, to look at the facts and see if, in fact, those theories comported with the fact. Microsoft did gather facts, found that the theories that the expert propounded were contradicted by the facts, but the court did not resolve that dispute. The court, yes.
Where did this standard come from?
That standard has been applied by some federal trial courts. In some cases, there's one of the most, to my mind, notorious of them is a case called In Re Catfish from the South. And it's been applied by a few federal trial courts, but it has not been endorsed by any federal court of appeals. And in fact, it is patently inconsistent with many of the recent federal court of appeals decisions that are now coming down now that Rule 23F has been added to the federal rules, which now allows much easier appellate review of class certification decisions. So the first error that the circuit court committed was in this not so insubstantial and illusory as to amount to no method at all. That's really no standard at all, and we contend that it's an error of law. A related way of expressing that was that the circuit court held that the plaintiffs only had to come forward with a, quote, threshold showing, unquote, of common impact on class members that did not even require class or plaintiffs to be able to show that all class members were injured. So it would have been okay, according to the circuit court, if it turned out that some class members weren't even injured, even though the plaintiffs had no method by common proof to determine which class members were and which class members were not injured. That is also an error of law. The circuit court also...
Isn't that going to result in two trials?
Well,
one for certification and one for unmerits, if you get the certification?
Well, the problem, Chief Justice Gilbertson, is that it could result in not two trials, but in a multitude of trials, because the issues in determining whether a certain person was injured or not are highly individual and specific to the channel that the person purchased it through. And so it just the key problem here in this case, and where we contend that the plaintiffs went wrong, was that they simply don't have a method for taking the diversity that exists in how these products get to market and showing that the so-called overcharge was in fact sustained by the people that Microsoft sells to directly, computer manufacturers, distributors, middlemen like that, and that it's passed through all the way through the chain of distribution down to the end user class
members.
This is
an indirect case, as I understand. And so you're saying that the bottom line is the people that are in the class, are they the ultimate consumer?
Yes. Yes, the class member.
And you're saying that there's no way showing how you can quantify or calculate what the actual damages are to the class?
That is precisely correct, Justice Amundson.
Is this?
You know, I always go back, and you never forget some of your own experiences. I used to live in a smaller community, and I went in to buy an appliance from an individual. I said, I can go to Target in Rapid City, the big city where your cohort's from, and buy it for $10 less. And a guy said to me, well, it costs me more than that. I can't sell it for it. But, I mean, that's how the market works, you're saying? You don't know what happened, how this passed on?
Yes, that's exactly correct. And, in fact, the plaintiffs came forward with two affidavits from an associate professor of economics named Keith Leffler, who teaches at the University of Washington. He's an associate professor out there. And he came up with strictly theoretical methods, methods that were never tested, methods on which he applied no data. He did no work to establish that his theoretical methods would, in fact, work when applied to the data from South Dakota or, frankly, any other state.
But isn't this still the best way to manage this issue? I mean, if we say there should be no class certification, all right, the only other way I can perceive that a person can get redress if there is a claim is to have thousands of individual suits in South Dakota for, what are they claiming, $30 a person or whatever. It would clog the courts. It would make a chaotic mess. Doesn't that point towards at least adjudicating the claims within the class action method versus letting everybody willy-willy file their own lawsuits?
Well, Chief Justice Gilbertson, the claims can be adjudicated within the class action mechanism only if they fit the statutory definition of the class action mechanism. SDCL 1633 says that procedural rules may not modify substantive rights. And in the case that the court is postulating, if the court allows a case which doesn't meet the class certification requirements to be nevertheless adjudicated as a class action, that rule is violated. And it's a significant one because whether or not a case meets the class action criteria is a matter of fundamental fairness, and it's also a matter of due process.
I thought you just said it was a procedural rule.
Well, it's a procedural rule, but it rests on, it's only permitted, that procedure is only permitted if it meets fundamental rules of due process. The claims, in fact, have to be common for them to be able to be tried as a unit and for the defendant and the plaintiff class to be bound by them.
So you're saying Microsoft would rather defend 15,000 individual lawsuits in South Dakota than one class action?
Well, no. And I think the likelihood of there being 15,000 class actions in South Dakota or individual cases in South Dakota is very unlikely. The claims are so small that it's highly likely that they will not be brought as individual claims by individual end users. But under both South Dakota law and also the federal antitrust law, direct purchasers have the claim. And if indeed there has been an overcharge, direct purchasers, some of whom are very large, Gateway, for example, could certainly bring a claim in South Dakota if it wanted to and assert that it was overcharged and it paid the overcharge. And under federal laws, Microsoft would not be able to assert as a defense that those overcharges, if proved, were passed on to consumers. So there is a mechanism. There's also an attorney general, parens patriae action, that could be brought. So it's not as if the citizens of South Dakota will have no relief if the class action is not certified.
Now, but a class action once certified is not cast in concrete, is it? It can be decertified after if there's other things that come up to show that the class isn't appropriate as the case goes on. Is that right?
That's true. Yeah. The facts change. That is correct. Mm-hmm. The California Supreme Court recently faced that very question. In a case called Washington Mutual Bank versus Superior Court, decided in January of 2001, I believe. And the court said, yes, but that doesn't reduce the burden of the plaintiffs to demonstrate that the class certification requirements were, in fact, met the first time. It's not okay for a judge to say, well, I could change my mind later, so I'll just certify this.
So, not to be to interrupt you, but I am.
Are you saying, then, that a trial judge
should make a determination at this initial stage on which expert is more credible?
What I'm saying is that the trial judge must decide whether the requirements for class certification are met.
But and isn't that what it amounts to?
Credibility
issue on experts?
In
this case, it appears to.
In this case, it doesn't really require credibility determination here. It requires measuring what the plaintiff did as against what the defendant did. Here, the plaintiff came forward with no evidence, no data, nothing at all to demonstrate that his methods would work. The defendants, by contrast, produced data, and I'll go through that in just a moment, produced data demonstrating that the plaintiff's theories were just
like
theories.
Is this like a Dalbert thing where the expert isn't qualified because he doesn't have a reliable theory that's been tested?
It's similar, although this does not go to the qualifications of the expert, but it really goes to whether he has met the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence that the case has met the class certification requirements. And when you come in with a method that is simply theoretical, then that's just no method at all. For example...
Excuse me. Doesn't that mean then you get into a whole fact-finding hearing that really goes to the merits of the case, and then you get into the questions of discovery and how does the plaintiff discover prior to him being certified as a class? How does that work?
Well, Judge Meyer-Henry, it does require a certain amount of exchange of information, and courts almost everywhere allow discovery on class certification issues, and there was such discovery here in South Dakota. And it does require the court to resolve issues of fact if they pertain to the elements of class certification. Now, where I would take issue with Your Honor is that you mentioned, doesn't that require the court to get into the merits? And the answer to that question is no. The court need not get into the merits. It is not appropriate for the court at this stage of things to say we think the plaintiffs are going to win, or we think the defendants are going to win, or we think the plaintiffs are more likely, or the defendants are more likely. What is essential, however, is for the court to resolve every question that needs to be resolved on the issue of is the method common that the plaintiffs have produced here or not. And that's all we're asking, is that decision be made. And we're fortunate to have some recent appellate guidance on that very issue. In the first place, the only appellate court to rule on the issues of class certification in these Microsoft cases has now ruled. The Michigan Court of Appeals unanimously ruled on August 27th that the trial court's certification of a class there was an abuse of discretion. The trial court in Michigan relied on precisely the same affidavits of Professor Leffler that were submitted in South Dakota, and in a very well-reasoned opinion, the court found that the showing that Professor Leffler made was simply inadequate. The court found
that being appealed to the Michigan Supreme Court for seeking review.
No, the time for seeking review has expired, and neither side asked for review of that. So that is the last decision we'll hear from Michigan, unless there's an appeal following the final judgment. Okay. But in the Michigan case, the court looked at the data that Microsoft produced, looked at the theories, the unsubstantiated theories that Professor Leffler came forward with, and said the plaintiff must do more than promise that a damage calculation using common proof will be available in the future. The court said that Professor Leffler's methods were so lacking in detail and grounding in the real world that they were slogans, not methods of proof. The court, this is the Michigan Court of Appeals, found that the affidavits provided by Professor Leffler provide no reasonable basis on which a court might reach the conclusion that a regression analysis, which is his way of proving pass-on, would actually compute the amount of the pass-on rate on a class-wide basis.
And how did the trial court deal with that issue here?
Disagreed. The trial court here said that it did not believe it was proper, a class certification, for it to decide whether or not the plaintiff's expert was correct in what his presumption was. And that's one of the errors that was committed by the circuit court here. The court thought it shouldn't, and it was concerned about getting into the merits, and it thought that as long as the plaintiff's supposed expert, who provided a theory that some jury might believe, that was all that the circuit court should do, and that the circuit court should not actually resolve a difference between the experts. And the Michigan Court of Appeals, of course, found that that decision had to be resolved. And in addition to that, there were two recent decisions of federal circuit courts of appeals that are almost precisely on point here. The first one is a case called West versus Prudential Securities, which was decided by the Seventh Circuit in 2002. In that case, the district judge did almost exactly what the circuit court did here, and it was reversed as an abuse of discretion to certify a class. What happened there was that, I'm quoting now from the Seventh Circuit's language, the judge observed that each side had the support of a reputable financial economist and thought the class itself enough to support class certification and the trial on merits. And therefore, simply certified the class. The court reversed that, saying that that was not proper. The court went on, the court here said that it did not believe that it should, quote, should not resolve the dispute in the expert's opinions. That's at paragraph 43 of the circuit court's opinion here. Should not resolve the dispute in the expert's opinions. The Seventh Circuit, in the West versus Prudential case, responded to that by saying, that amounts to a delegation of judicial power to the plaintiffs, who can obtain class certification just by hiring a competent expert.
A district judge must
not duck hard questions by observing that each side has some support. Tough questions must be faced and squarely decided. And the court goes on to point out that even if those points are enmeshed in the merits in some fashion, if they're important to class certification, they have to be decided. And the court went on to point out that the reason for this is that, again, I'm quoting from the Seventh Circuit, data may upset theory. And that's exactly what happened here. The data upset the theory. There's another...
This Michigan case that you rely on.
Yes.
Talks about the dueling paradigms of skeptical versus sanguine approach to these types of cases. Do you think there's some indications in South Dakota law whether our precedent is the one side or the other?
Well, that paradigm came from an article by Professor Page in 99. And I believe that the Trapp versus Madera case in South Dakota would suggest that South Dakota requires that the requirements be proved. And that this court should do so, just like the Michigan court did. The federal circuit courts of appeals are going that way very heavily. And indeed, another case from the Seventh Circuit called Szabo versus Bridgeport Machines, which is a Seventh Circuit case in 2001, again held that questions that are, quote, vital to any sensible decision about class certification have to be
resolved.
The court said, before deciding whether to allow a case to proceed as a class action, a judge should make whatever factual and legal inquiries are necessary under Rule 23. I think that is closer to the more, I would have called that the more realistic standard of what needs to be done in order for the plaintiffs to prove their case. The plaintiffs here fell far short.
The Federal Left Court came in with a conceptual method. He said, I've only been asked to describe the kinds of methods I would like to use.
I can only evaluate in a conceptual rather than empirical way the likely class-wide methods of damage calculations. He said he's going to rely on basic economic principles. He's going to rely on the economics literature. These are all language of conjecture and promise, which is exactly what the Michigan court said. Now, compare that to what the defendants did. The defendants actually went out and gathered data. For example, the defendants had surveys done
in the computer process in six different states.
Found that
a single computer can be sold for, this is a compact server computer, can be sold for $1,399
in one store in one state, and in the same state sold for $1,899. Another computer, also a compact computer, was sold for $1,190 in one store and $1,799 in another store in the same state. Now, Professor Leffler has no way to deal with facts like that. He also
has show that no matter whether you sold it for $1,800 or $1,300, they paid the same price for what they got from your client? Can they show that?
No. Professor Leffler has no methodology for showing that, and that is the problem.
There was also, we had testimony from Linda Shore, who was a person in this field, who, and her affidavit at paragraph 12, which is
your
on page.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Okay. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Mr. Marino, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel, it's nice to be back in front of the court. I'd like to address many of the remarks made by my esteemed colleague, Mr. Casper. First of all, with regard to the Michigan case, the court needs to be aware that the Michigan case is a damages case and a superiority case. A lot of Microsoft's arguments in their brief pertain to the issue of impact. Microsoft is now relying on the Michigan case. The problem is the Court of Appeals in Michigan ruled against Microsoft on the impact element. So we're only dealing here, if Microsoft's arguments are going to make any sense, we're only dealing here with their damages argument if they're relying on the Michigan case. Now, Microsoft says that class management is an issue in this case. I read their petition for discretionary review last night and again just a moment ago. There isn't any indication that superiority is an issue before this court. They didn't raise the question of direct review based on superiority. They're now trying to backdoor superiority in because the Michigan Court of Appeals relied on unmanageability as a basis to reverse the trial court. Mr. Casper makes mention of the Falcon case and the rigorous analysis. I would direct the court to page 7, paragraph 13 of Judge Zitcher's opinion, where he specifically cited to that case and said that he is applying and did apply the rigorous analysis. The overcharge issue. Microsoft argues that we can't calculate or measure overcharges. One of the problems that they don't tell you that they have is their own retained expert, Dr. Hall, testified in the multi-district litigation case on December the 10th of 2001. In his testimony, he said that overcharge was calculated. In fact, to use his words, it was doable. And in my supplemental brief, I cite to or include the Florida case. The Florida case cites to and quotes from Dr. Hall's testimony in the MDL where he says that overcharge are calculatable. With regard to the shopping for an appliance that you raised, Justice Anderson, one of the things that we rely on and that Microsoft doesn't tell you is that when you went to go buy your appliance on day one, that appliance was already, the price of it was already inflated several years before that because of the monopolistic situation. What we're arguing here is that the super competitive price, the inflated price, was embedded in the 1980s and was already high by the time all of us as consumers were able to buy our product. So we were buying a product in which the price was already increased based on the illegal and monopolistic behavior of Microsoft. The gateway situation, the direct purchaser, there's a price increase. Well, when you have an embedded increase in price, a super competitive price, the intermediary or the direct purchaser like Gateway will pass on that increased price if there's a certain amount of time period involved. In this situation, that's precisely what we are alleging. That's precisely in the analysis that Dr. Leftwood took us through. Justice Amundson, you brought up the question of class certification is not cast in stone. Absolutely not. In fact, our position is that the class certification issue was not dead in Michigan, that that's an interlocutory type of order, and that the plaintiff there certainly has the right to request and seek a class certification on a more expanded and developed record. I want to touch briefly on the Michigan case because it's cited ad nauseum in Microsoft's reply brief. There's several differences that this court needs to be aware of with regard to the Michigan case. First of all, there's a different standard of review. Michigan applies a clear error standard. This court in the Trapp case made it very clear that the standard is one of abuse of discretion. Secondly, the statute involved in Michigan is substantially different, at least in our view, than here. In Michigan, the damages statute says that you must prove actual damages sustained. Our statute, 37.1.14.3, says that the proof is one of damages sustained. The actual is not in there. And I wouldn't have had the benefit of my esteemed colleague, Mr. Barnum, to argue the Michigan case. And he provided me a transcript of the oral argument in the Michigan case. And there's several comments that Judge Whitbeck, the author of the Michigan case, made during the course of oral argument. And it's clear that Judge Whitbeck was concerned about the fact that Michigan was different than other states, because the legislature chose to use the words actual damages sustained.
which is different than our statutory scheme.
In fact, Judge Whitbeck...
Is this part of our record to review?
It is not. It's certainly one that the court can take judicial notice of, or I can provide the court and counsel.
Well, I think if you're arguing it, I'd like to see a copy of it.
Right. I'd be happy to provide a copy to you following the argument.
Copy what now?
This is a copy of the transcript of the oral argument to the Michigan Court of Appeals in the A&M Supply case. And there's three references where Judge Whitbeck talks about this distinction.
And if he's arguing, I think we should.
Our rule usually is on late authority, file 7 copies with the clerk
and serve a copy in counsel.
Do I have leave then to do so? Because I know once argument is had, I have to seek leave. Or do I? You want
go ahead.
To present? Okay. Thank you. The point I'm trying to make is this. The statutory schemes in Michigan and South Dakota are different. And because Michigan requires proof of actual damages, the court there was compelled to believe that a more rigid standard of proof was required. As Justice Konenkamp, you pointed out, or at least suggested, the standard in South Dakota with regard to proof of damages is not nearly as rigid as in Michigan. In your McKee case that's cited in our briefs, you make it very clear that it's a reasonable basis standard in terms of proof here. If you compare that reasonable basis standard with the standard applied in Michigan, you'll see a big difference. And the difference is attributable to the difference in the statutory language. What other differences are there between the Michigan case and our case? One of them is the record. Mr. Casper says, well, the records are identical. In both cases, you had affidavits from Dr. Leftwood. We supplemented our record in this case, and the court granted us leave to do so. And we included Dr. Leffler's evidentiary hearing testimony in the Florida case. And I think that evidentiary hearing testimony is very instructive because Dr. Leffler takes you through everything that he does in terms of measuring and calculating impact and damages.
Was that submitted to the trial court?
That was not, Your Honor. And the reason that it was not is the Florida case was handed down after Judge Zinter's decision in the trial court, but it is before this court now.
So should it be remanded for the trial court to consider that new evidence?
No, because it simply reinforces what Judge Zinter already concluded, namely that there was that the relevant standard in terms of a threshold showing of impact and damages has been met. But Microsoft argues that Professor Leffler didn't run his methodologies using actual data. The problem is...
So let me go one further. Are you saying that your showing to the trial court was insufficient to sustain the findings and conclusions that the trial court entered, and that you need that deposition filed subsequent to support the findings and conclusions before this court?
Absolutely not.
We believe that there's more than sufficient evidence to establish the threshold showing based on just the record before Judge Zinter. But Microsoft is the one that is arguing that the records are different or that the records are the same. I'm simply pointing out that the record before this court is not the same as the record that was before the Michigan Court of Appeals.
And when you say threshold showing, I think counsel mentioned that. Are you saying that's all you have to make, have certification, period?
Right.
Justice Amundson, if we accept Microsoft's position, they're going to make us prove our case. They're going to make us basically show our case for the jury at the class certification stage.
So then, as far as with this Dr. Leffler, what you're saying then is he would testify exactly in South Dakota as to how he testified in Florida?
If this case went to trial, yes. And maybe
he's using the same procedures or formulas or whatever to calculate damages wherever he goes, or does he differ because of jurisdiction?
No,
or what?
He doesn't differ between jurisdictions.
He's the one that used yardsticks, right?
When you're right, he uses yardsticks and regression analysis. And what he did in Florida
is we finally got some data from Microsoft. I mean, this has been years and years long battle to get data from Microsoft to run these methodologies. Microsoft is saying
you don't have the data, so you can't calculate the damages. We're saying we got to get the data in part from you, and we're finally getting it. And by the time we got to Florida, which was just a recent decision, Dr. Loeffler finally had some data, hard data from Microsoft and some others, so that he could run sample illustrative regression analyses, and that's what he did. So he was able to show in Florida that he can measure impact, he can measure damages using the data that was that was available to him.
Is different data and information needed? You know, we don't live in a isolation. I remember reading about the federal case where the government's involved. Is that data that is accessible for Dr. Loeffler to look at that was in the federal court? I think there's a Judge Jackson and some of those involved in that. Is that, wasn't that data available?
That data was available, and Dr. Loeffler,
I know it's a different type of case rather than indirect purchase.
It was available, and he did use it, and that's what he used as a basis or a fulcrum for his methodologies and his opinions that these are going to work. These are doable. Now, again, I want to emphasize to you with regard to this this pass-on situation, Dr. Hall, who is Microsoft's own expert, says that this is doable, that you can measure overcharge, that you can calculate the amount of overcharges that go to consumers.
Did they assume on overcharge that the whole overcharge is passed on, or is there a dispute on that?
There's a dispute on that.
Because every retailer or seller could operate different, right?
Well, but Dr. Loeffler is assuming, I mean, they want you to assume that there's these myriad of differences.
Right now, but I mean, do they all pass on the same amount?
Probably not. They probably.
They all pass on the same amount. Then are damages different for the inline purchaser?
Dr. Loeffler addressed that specific point and said that through his regression analysis, because there are some differences, he can take into account those differences and still calculate the amount of the reasonably estimate the amount of the pass through.
Is regression analysis, and is that accepted procedure in the economic and expert area?
But by Microsoft's own experts, Dr. Hall, Dr. Houseman, Dr. Schmalensee.
So there's no dispute on that?
I don't think so. Now, my colleague may say that there is, but I don't think so. We believe that it's very important that you take into account Dr. Hall's own testimony, because we don't think Microsoft can have it both ways. You can't put up an expert that says overcharge is calculatable and then argue that there's too many variables. With regard to the complexity and the variable aspect, I want to point out to you the line of cases from our U.S. Supreme Court, and it's also addressed in the key case that Justice Conan handled, that a wrongdoer, a monopolist, can't hide behind its own complexity and immunize itself from damages. And that's exactly what Microsoft is trying to do. It's an age-old principle. The Story Parchment case is a 1931 case. It goes all the way back there. And our U.S. Supreme Court has said that when you're a wrongdoer, when you're a monopolist or you commit antitrust violations, you can't hide behind some complex, convoluted scheme and say, you can't get any damages from me, or you can't get class certification. And our U.S. Supreme Court and this court said that as well. With regard to the standards applied in the Michigan case, we want to highlight the a case by the name of Wang, W-A-N-G, versus Becken, 310 Northwest 2nd, 166, the 1981 case, where this court says there must simply be a reasonable basis for measuring a loss. That's what Justice Conan said in the McKee case, but it's very clear the standard of proof with regard to the measurement of losses or damages is much more relaxed or lenient than in the Michigan case.
There's also some language about the trial court having to do a rigorous analysis. Does this meet that?
Absolutely, it meets it. I mean, Judge Zinter, if I've looked at all trial court decisions, obviously, and Judge Zinter has written probably the most comprehensive decision of all of them regarding the class certification issue. It clearly indicates that he applied a rigorous analysis. And Judge Zinter, as you're all aware, ruled from the bench and then took several months before actually entering written findings and conclusions. And it's clear that he pondered this thing a great deal and spent a lot of time on it.
Why was the language used in paragraph 15 of his findings that the theory was not so insubstantial or illusory as to be no standard at all? That hardly appears to be a rigorous review standard.
That's the standard that's been used by the vast majority of courts, federal and state, that have reviewed the issue. Our position is whatever the standard is, whether you want to use that and put on top of a rigorous analysis, Judge Zinter more than met that standard. It's clear that he applied a rigorous analysis in this case, and he said so. He said so in his decision. He said, I'm aware of the Falcon decision, I'm aware of what it requires, and I am compliant with the dictates of that decision. He says that in on page 7, paragraph 13 of his written decision. Any other questions?
Nothing further? Are you completed your presentation then?
One thing I will say is, with regard to the Michigan cases, I don't think that that's a final decision. It's certainly not one that that forecloses this court from rendering a counter decision. We believe that there are a whole myriad of distinctions between this case and the Michigan case.
Safe to say that there is no majority-type rule as far as on your expert, Dr. Leffler. It seems like some states accept him and some don't.
Well,
I mean, Maine is another one that didn't find it was a proper showing, didn't they?
Maine and Michigan are the
And I think there are other cases from other jurisdictions where